Hi, and welcome to the Screencast. My name is Chris Bowen, and I'm a developer evangelist with Microsoft, covering the Northeast United States. You can reach me at cbowen@microsoft.com, and my blog is blogs.msdn.com/cbowen. This is based on the content we delivered as part of our Northeast MSDN Roadshow series in the spring of 2009, and it's a brief introduction to creating games using the XNA framework. We'll begin by taking a look at what XNA is. I'll show you where to download what you need to create your own games in XNA, and where to find more about learning to develop games in XNA. And then we'll turn our attention to actually creating a very basic two-dimensional game using Visual Studio and the XNA framework. But first, let's begin by taking a look at the actual components of XNA, and to show you how things interrelate. At the top of the diagram, we have Visual Studio 2008, into which the XNA framework will add a number of project and item templates, some tools that will help us to create games more efficiently. The XNA framework itself offers a set of abstractions specifically targeted toward game creation that build upon the features of the .NET framework. Now, as you can see beneath the XNA framework here is the .NET framework, both the full .NET framework and the compact framework as well. And which one is used is determined by what target device you're deploying your game to. And currently, XNA Game Studio supports developing games for Windows, the Xbox 360, and Zune. So let's talk about Visual Studio in a little more detail. Visual Studio 2008, any version of Visual Studio 2008 will work with XNA. So if you have access to standard pro or higher of 2008, you can go ahead and install XNA on top of that and use that just fine. If you don't have access to those, you can download the free version of Visual Studio. So Visual Studio C# Express 2008, you can download that for free and then install XNA on top of that, and you'll be able to create games just fine using that as well. You can take advantage of all of the recent updates to the language of C# in the 3.0 version. So you can see here all the features that are in are new to C# 3.0. As mentioned before, you can develop games for Windows, the Xbox 360, and Zune. I should mention that Windows and Zune are free to develop for. You can go ahead and just create those using all the tools that I'll talk about in this screencast. The Xbox 360 does require a special license that you can acquire, and there's plenty of information about that on the creator site that I'll be showing you in just a moment. The last point on this is that if you're using Visual Studio to target games on multiple devices, multiple platforms, you can have one solution, for example, that would share resources and code between the various projects. So very commonly, you'll see, for example, a Windows project and a Zune project inside the same solution. And you could take advantage of the features of Visual Studio to help share assets and code between those two different deployed applications. So now I'd like to take a look at some of the websites that you can go to download XNA and to actually learn more about creating your own games in XNA. The most important site to begin with is the Creators Club Online, which is at creators.xna.com. And it's the most important link to recall from the session. So if you go to creators.xna.com, you'll find a bunch of resources for downloading XNA, for learning about the different aspects of XNA. And also, as you can see on this main page, there's a whole community around developing games for the Xbox Live Arcade. There's actually a special blade within Xbox Live called Community Games, and people have been developing games using XNA for upload to this community blade that can be sold for points within Xbox Live. So if your game's good enough, you can actually upload your game, sell it, and then potentially turn a profit. So if you've ever dreamed about creating games as your own game development company and wanted to look into that, this is actually a nice, interesting way of getting into that, taking advantage of XNA to make that whole process even easier. But the main thing to point out about this page is on the right-hand side is the XNA Game Studio 3 link. Let's click on that, show you how to actually get XNA installed and to get working with XNA Game Studio. So I mentioned XNA itself builds upon Visual Studio 2008. If you don't already have it installed, and you don't have access to one of the higher levels of Visual Studio, so standard, pro, or higher, you can go to the downloads page for the Express Edition, and that's microsoft.com/express/download. And what you'll want to download is, in the middle here, Visual C# 2008 Express Edition. You can download and install that, again for free, and then come back to this link, and click on the XNA Game Studio 3 link that's on this page, and it will bring you to the downloads page for Game Studio 3, which will install on top of whatever flavor of Visual Studio 2008 you have currently installed, and will add in all of those features that I mentioned before that will let you create games for Windows, for the Xbox, and for the Zune, with project item templates, and also tools, and the framework itself. So going back to the XNA Creator site, back to the main page, wanted to show you the other options that are available to you. You can go to the community, which you can find plenty of forums, other people that have been developing games with XNA. But I would like you to first check out the Education tab, which has a wealth of information for you. First of all, it's a Getting Started guide, which you can click on, and it will offer you a set of tutorials. First, a tutorial to create a two-dimensional space shooter game. And if you scroll down, you can see there's also a three-dimensional tutorial as well. What's nice about these tutorials is that they're step-by-step with full source code and also videos to show you at each step of the way what you should be doing. So there's basically a guide to walk you through what to do for each part of these game development processes. Also, the Educational tab has the Education Catalog. This is a great resource to turn to if you're looking for specific things that you want to learn more about creating games within Game Developer Studio. So there's, on the right-hand side, a catalog of different kinds of content that we have, from articles to mini-games to different tutorials and utilities, and also separated out by the actual topic you can see here. That there's a set of different areas here, from how do you do collision to how do you deal with graphics and storing information. All these areas are separated out into different dev areas within the Education Catalog. But of all these things, I wanted to point out that there's a content type called Starter Kit. I'll go ahead and click on that and show you what's available. There's a number of these starter kits which you can download and install, and they'll add themselves into Visual Studio and will basically give you a chance to create very easily a new game with all of the assets that you would need, sounds, graphics, and the source code. And you just basically get up to speed very quickly to create and run a brand new game within Visual Studio. Here are some of them. You can download these. You can see one of them is premium content, so you would need the Content Creators Club to download that one. But the other ones are completely free, and you can download them. I've gone ahead and done that, so I want to show you those in action. So I'm going to fire up Visual Studio, and I want to show you the templates that have been added because I downloaded a number of those starter kits in addition to installing XNA Game Studio. So if I do File, New, Project, and then go to the XNA tab within that New Project dialog down here near the bottom, you'll see there's quite a few more options than you'll see the first time you do this, but once you install all the starter kits, you'll see all of these as well. Basically, I have all the basic options that I would need to create a game within XNA Game Development Studio. From at the very top, you can see Windows game, Xbox 360 game, Zune game. All the way down at the bottom here, you can see various starter kits from Marvelous, Netrumble, to the role-playing games, and basically, is it on Windows or on the Xbox 360? You can choose which starter kit you want, and it will go ahead and create that game and let you work with it. So I want to begin by showing you one of these starter kits, and the Platformer Starter Kit is a nice one to show because it actually creates a solution that has more than one target device as part of it. So I'll just go ahead and take the defaults here. We'll create it on my desktop. I'll say OK, and this can take a little bit of time because it's going to go ahead and generate all of the different projects. There'll be three projects in the solution. It's going to import all of the assets that it needs, including sound, the graphics assets that it needs, and then generate all the code and help files that we would need to begin working with this game. So you can see now it's created the solution for me. You can see the game is Platformer 1, and I'm within Visual Studio and can start working with the code. So let me go ahead and show you. I'll collapse down these various projects once it stops thinking about this. Okay, so we've got our Zune copy. I'll collapse down the Xbox copy. And at the very top is the source of the Windows copy. So we have three different projects within the same solution. So we can see here that we have, at the very top, Windows, Platformer 1, Xbox 360, and Zune. I'm going to begin by showing you what's inside Platformer 1. And you can see it's basically just C# code, things that we're familiar with from general work with Visual Studio and C# in general. So if I'm just go ahead and hit run, we'll get this game running. And there it is. I'll center it on the screen so we can see it. But it's your basic scrolling platformer game, and by default, the startup game was the Windows version. So I can go ahead and start playing the game, jump, collect the gems, all kinds of fun stuff, win the game, or win the level. So I basically just hit F5, and I have a working full game that I can then go back into Visual Studio and work with. So I have all the code that I need, and I'm not going to go through the code just yet. We want to actually go ahead and create our very first game, a simpler 2D game, and I'll show you all the code for that. But basically, just pointing out, with this and all the other starter kits, you get all the content, you get all of the source code, and you also get some documentation to help you understand what the game is composed of. So let's go ahead now and close down Visual Studio. And I want to actually build a game from scratch using XNA. We'll basically build a very simple two-dimensional game, and it's the what I like to call the hello world of the gaming development industry, and it's Pong. So to create Pong, I'm going to bring up Visual Studio again, and we'll go to the File menu, File, New, Project. And again, you need to have Game Studio 3.0 installed on top of any flavor of Visual Studio 2008. And once you do that, you'll see on this tab a number of the templates that I have here. You won't see all of them until you install the starter kits manually from the creator's site. But what we want to use now is the Windows Game template, which you will have by default. And we'll change the name to Pong and say OK. And that will go ahead and create a solution for us and a project inside of that with a basic structure set up for us to begin creating a game. Before I talk about the actual code and content here, I just want to run the game to show you the awesomeness that is our first game. And here it is. It's a basic window with a blue background that is staring unblinkingly back at us. And it's not that interesting. But I will point out that it's doing a number of things for us that may not be readily apparent. So it's handling for us the creation of this window and also the execution of what's called the game loop. And that is happening many times per second. And each time it happens, it's asking, has anything happened in the game? So the game logic. Is there anything I need to compute for you or determine? And the next part of that phase is there anything I need to draw to the screen? So many times per second, depending on how you've configured your game, or the actual hardware that you're deploying to, this loop is being executed. But we haven't written any code for that just yet, and so it's not doing anything interesting just yet. So let's go ahead and do that. So if you look in the project in the Solution Explorer, you'll see a few things that are potentially familiar to you from Windows development in general, and then a few other things that are specific to XNA. So projects, properties, and references are fairly standard things and set up for us automatically. The content folder here is new and specific to XNA, and it's related to what's called the content pipeline within XNA. We'll talk about this a little bit later on. We want to add some graphics to our game, but really that's just a folder that helps us to import and deal with various sounds and things that we want to display on the screen. Next, we have the game's icon, and then a couple of CS files. So the actual program CS, which basically just launches the game itself. It's not terribly interesting. What we'll spend most of our time is in game1.cs, which is the overall concept of the game, including that game loop that I mentioned before. We'll be adding our logic to that file in just a moment. Before we begin, I want to mention what's happening in part of the as part of the Pong game itself. So Pong, if you may recall from years back, is basically just a couple of paddles left and right and a ball that's flitting back and forth between them. So we can take advantage of the fact that XNA is based on the .NET framework by using C# and object-oriented techniques to create the concepts and the actors within our game. So I'm going to begin by adding a couple of classes into the Pong project here. So I'll right-click, and we'll say add class. I'll bring this in. We'll begin by adding a ball.cs file. And then while I'm here, I might as well add the paddle as well. So I'll say add class paddle.cs. And because I don't want to spend a lot of time typing, I'm going to go into my magic toolbox. We'll pin this here. And I have a number of things already written that will just basically drag and drop into the sample. So I'll begin with the paddle class. We'll delete the class definition here and just drag and drop some code over from these pre-rendered definitions. So in the paddle class, we've got a couple of things. I'm going to mention, we'll go to full screen here. And first of all, it doesn't know what point is yet because I haven't added a using statement for it just yet. But basically what I want to do is say adding a using statement for the XNA framework. So I'll say, yes, please do that. You can see at the top of our code, it's added in the using statement for the Microsoft.xna.framework, which defines the point class for us. And basically point is just something that knows about an X and a Y coordinate. I should mention that when we run the game, you saw that rectangle, and the rectangle is a coordinate system that has the X and the Y position of things that we want to render to the screen, starting with 0, comma 0 as the top left corner, and then the height and the width of the window being the bottom right point. So in the paddle class, I want to track just a couple of things. So here we have a variable called position, or pause, and that's based on a point, which is the actual location of where that paddle is, or more specifically, where the top left corner of the paddle is within the coordinates space of the game. The second thing on line 13 is the speed of the paddle, and we'll use that to determine just how many pixels or units the paddle will move in each update of the game. And finally, on line 16, we have a constructor for the paddle, which accepts an X and a Y location and generates a new point based on that, assigns it into the pause variable, and then also gives us a default speed that we can then adjust later on if we wanted to within the game. We'll do a similar thing, but a bit more complicated with the ball class. So I'm going to go over back into here. I'll delete the ball definition. We'll go over to, we'll get out of full screen here. We'll go back into the ball snippet. I'll drag and drop that over here. And again, I'll go back into full screen. You can see that point is also telling us that we don't have the using statement. I'll go ahead and add that. And you can see there's a little bit more code inside of the ball definition than there was in the paddle. And that's because the ball needs to travel in more than one direction. The paddle only goes up and down on the screen, whereas the ball can go left and right as well. And so we need to reflect that. We still have the location as a pause variable, POS, and that's the point, X and Y, of the top left corner of the ball. Next, on line 13, we have two speed variables. We have the horizontal speed, H underscore speed, and V underscore speed for the vertical component of that speed. Now, if you're more familiar with XNA, or you become more familiar with XNA, you'll begin to learn that there's more advanced classes that I could use to more effectively do this part of the code. In particular, you could use what's called a vector. And a vector will help you to reflect basically the speed that we're trying to code up inside the ball here. But for now, to keep it easier, I'm just going to break these things out into their component horizontal and vertical speed components. Now, we still have a constructor here as well. And I'll show the whole constructor here. We have the X and the Y being provided to the ball constructor. Again, we're going to create that location, the position, as a point. But what's new is we're going to use a random variable to generate the initial speed components. So this is because each time we create a new ball instance, we don't want it to always go in the same direction. That would make an even more boring game than we're going to get when we finish this. So we're going to make that random, and so it's going to choose some random number within a constraint and assign that to both the horizontal and the vertical component of speed within some bounds. Okay, so those added, let's go back into our game1.cs file, which you can get to here or through the Solution Explorer. I'll leave full screen just to show you the longer way of getting to it. So back here, game1.cs. I had mentioned before, is really the central place that we're adding a lot of the logic for our game. So game1.cs starts with the using statements that are created for us automatically. But I want to point out on line 17 here, you can see that public class game1 is actually defined in terms of the Microsoft XNA framework game class. And this provides us a lot of default implementations that we can use, but it also specifically gives us a number of methods that we can choose to override in our own game. And by default, 5 of these are overridden in our game when we create them from scratch. And so let me scroll down just to show you what these are. The first one is the initialize method. And this is our chance to add any creation logic that we would need to put into the game. For example, loading high scores, things like that. Just getting the game ready to run. The next override that we could look at, this is a pair, so I'll show them both together here, is load and unload content. These work together to work with the content pipeline to bring in and to unload any graphics information that you may need to display in the game. So we'll be adding some stuff to that a little bit later on. I had mentioned the game loop a little bit earlier, and the first part of that is here in the update method. So you can see on line 67 here, we have the update method, again an override of one of the methods in the game class from the XNA framework. And this is the, you can think of this as the brains of your game. This is going to be called many times per second, and it's going to say, since the last time I've called you, please check to see what's happened in the game. Has the ship moved anymore? Has anyone pressed a key on a gamepad or on the keyboard? Has someone collided with something else? Is a player dead or something like that? And so basically all the logic of the game finds its root within this update method. And so again, we're going to come back to this method and add some stuff in just a little bit. To end things within the Game1CS, we have this draw method, which is the second part of the duo that makes the game loop. And so, whereas update is the brains, this is basically the beauty of the game. And draw is called, again, many times per second, and it says, please update the screen to display anything that should be displayed at this point in time. And you can see there's that cornflower blue that I had mentioned before. These are just the default implementations of these methods that we get when Game Studio creates our game for us from the template. And so we're going to, again, add in our own content here as well. So earlier we added the paddle and the ball classes into our project, but we haven't brought them into the game just yet. So I'd like to do that by going to the top of the Game1CS file. Up here where there's some initial variables, I'm going to go back to our toolbox, and we'll bring over the pre-written variables snippet. Let's talk about what's in these. So the first line, on line 23, is a set of variables for textures that we're going to use to load in graphics through the content pipeline and display them to the screen. We'll get to that in just a moment. I want to focus on lines 25 and 26. There are instance variables for the left and the right paddle, and also the ball that will flip back and forth between them. Line 28, we're defining a random instance that we're using in the constructor of the ball class, and that we'll also use in another place as well later on. And finally, we've added a keyboard state variable that will help us to track the changes to the keyboard, the keys that are being pressed as the game is being updated through the game loop. So we've got the instance variables, but we haven't actually stored anything within them yet. So to do that, I'm going to make a method. We'll add this in. Again, I've got it already written. So a reset game method will help us to not only set up the game to begin with, but also to reset each point as the ball either falls off either end of the screen. And so you can see here we've got just a couple of constructor calls to the paddle class with some default magic number locations on the screen. And then finally on line 35 we're instantiating the ball, which is the center of the screen based on the default size we have for the screen. Yes? Which again is called the beginning of the game when we want to set everything up before the game begins to run. So we can see there's a to-do here for adding our initialization logic. Let's just make a call here to reset game. And we'll add that in there. And next, I could run the game, but you wouldn't see anything new, because even though we've instantiated the ball and the paddles, we haven't done anything to either work with them from a logical standpoint or to draw them to the screen. So let's go ahead and work on that. I'm going to leave full screen. And the first thing you need to do is to work with the content pipeline to bring some graphics into the game. So I'm going to go to the content folder here. Again, this is working with the content pipeline in XNA. I'm going to right-click on this and say Open Folder in Windows Explorer. What I want to do is just copy in some content that I already have in another folder. So I'll just take my graphics, which you can see are really nice, copy these over, and put these into the folder here. Now, that doesn't do anything by default. I need to actually bring those in through the content pipeline. So to do that, I can right-click on the content folder, and I'll say Add Existing Items, and you can see it's gone to that content directory that I added everything into. I'll pick everything here and have it add it for me. When I do that, you'll see each of those assets listed underneath the content pipeline. You can go through each of these and review the properties for each one of them, but basically XNA is taking care of the details for us. It's handling how to import and how to process each of those different graphical resources, so we don't have to worry about that quite as much. Again, you can dive into that detail if you need to, but by default, you know, we can pretty much just use these assets as is. So we have those assets imported through the content pipeline, but again, if I ran the game now, nothing would happen because we haven't drawn them to the screen. So the first thing we need to do is to actually bring these content assets in through the content pipeline and into those sets of variables that I had earlier. And just to show you that, again, that's up here on line 23. We have a set of texture 2D classes, which are basic classes that can be used to hold various PNG files, GIF files, JPEGs, things like that, that we may want to show on the screen. So to do that, I'm going to go to the load content method here. And we'll call this, we'll go up a little bit more. So here at the load content method, this is where we have our chance to import any graphics that we have in our game. So I'll remove the to-do, and we'll insert the load content that I have here. And let me go to full screen so I can talk about this. Okay, so here you can see what looks fairly complex, but it's very boilerplate code. Once you get this basic pattern down, you'll see it everywhere within XNA. What we're doing is on the left-hand side, we're defining the contents of some variable. Again, these are texture 2D variables, to be the results of calling through the content pipeline. So that's right here. So this is the content pipeline. We're asking it to load something, and we're calling into a generic method of load. So that means that it can work with a variety of different kinds of classes. We're being very specific here. We're saying we want a texture 2D to be loaded from this target in the content pipeline. And we're looking for an asset named paddle. So I can bring that in. I'm going to load that into the left and the right paddle textures. They could be different. That's why I have multiple variables here, if you wanted to have different paddles. They are the same in this version of the game. And then at the bottom, we have the ball texture being loaded from the ball asset, just like we had with the paddle. So now that we have these things loaded into variables, I can then turn to the second part of that game loop, the graphics update part, which is at the bottom here. I go down to draw, and again, remember this is the beauty of the game, whereas update is the brains. So we're in the very last method here. So I'm going to update draw to insert some code to use those textures that I loaded from the content pipeline and display them to the screen. So again, I'll leave full screen. We'll go to my conveniently written draw code. And by the way, I didn't mention this earlier, but all of the code that you see here is available for download as a resource for this screencast. And just check out the Northeast site on Channel 9, and I'll have a link for that at the end. So I'm going to insert the code here and talk about this as well. So in here, the draw method is called again many times per second, and the graphics device just clears it out and uses a default color. In fact, we can change this color right now because I don't really want cornflower blue. I think I'd rather have a more table tennis-like color, so let's go with dark green. And again, we have all full IntelliSense within Visual Studio, so I'll choose dark green as the background color when it clears out that graphics device. And then the next thing it does is it works with what's called a sprite batch, which we defined earlier as XNA defined it for us as part of the template. And a sprite batch, you can think of it as your ambassador to the graphics card. And basically it just says, I'm going to collect a bunch of information about some sprites that you want me to display on the screen, and it will take care of communicating with the graphics device of how to display those graphics on the screen. So I've again added some what becomes very boilerplate code. You'll be doing this, you know, very frequently in all of your own games, And so it's a very common pattern. We begin the sprite batch. We're saying, I'm going to be adding a few graphics that I'd like you to render for me. And then we call end when we're completed, when we've finished adding each of those in. So lines 107 through 109, we're just saying, okay, the sprite batch should draw the following things. Here's the texture that I want you to draw, T-paddle 1, 2, and the ball. And the next argument is a rectangle of where on the screen we should draw that graphic into. So basically we're trying to paint this graphic into a space that's defined by this rectangle. And it's pretty convenient because we can use the position of the paddle and the ball to figure out where to do that on the screen. So a rectangle is defined as the top left and the top right location, and then all the way down to, you know, what's the width and the height of that location. So basically we're giving it the top left corner and the bottom right corner as definition. So we can do that quite easily by saying, where is the left paddle? And let's ask for the x component of its position. I mentioned earlier the point class is just composed of an x and a y variable to reflect a point in a Cartesian plane. And so we just ask for the x, we ask for the y, and then we also say, starting from that top left corner, we're going to paint out a rectangle that is the following size: the width of the paddle and the height of the paddle. And that'll give us the top left all the way down to the bottom right, into which we'll paint that texture. We can also use this optional argument to recolor the graphic that we're trying to display, but I'll just go with white for these, for the paddles. And then at the same kind of idea, we have the ball being written. We end with a rectangle using the ball's position of the x and the y, and then also the ball width and the ball height. And in this case, we are recoloring it. We're using the Burleywood color just to differentiate it from the white that's the default of that graphic. Okay, and so we call spriteBatch.end, and then the default calls the base implementation of the draw, and that takes care of everything for us. So if I ran the game now, we should see an improvement to the overall game. So I'll hit 5 and we'll get the game running, and you can see its current state. We have the paddle on the left and the right, and the ball in the middle, slightly recolored with that Burleywood color. But you can see nothing's happening. We've added the beauty of the game with the draw method, but we haven't added the brains of the game with the update just yet. So we're missing quite a bit of code. We haven't done anything to take input or to react and create movement on the screen. So let's go ahead and do that next. I'll close down the game. Let's go back into our code. I'm going to go up to the update method. This is what we're going to use to add, again, the brains of the game into and really affect what the paddles are doing and what the ball is doing. So to do that, I'm going to call into a few methods that I'll add here related to updating the paddle and the ball. So I'm going to leave full screen again. We'll add a couple more methods in as well. And I'm going to go down to the bottom. Let's add them down here. So the first thing I'll add is update ball. I'll drag that in here. And while I'm adding in code, I might as well add in the update paddles as well. So we'll add in both of those. Now let's go and take a look at the update ball method. Go back to full screen here. Update ball is pretty straightforward. All we're looking at is the current position of the ball. And you can see here lines 118 and 119 are incrementing its location based on the current speed. So what's happening here? Many times per second we're calling update, which we'll then call update ball. We haven't done that yet, I'll add that in a moment. But update ball is going to say, okay, for this update of what's happening, let's add the current speed of the ball in the horizontal and vertical components and update the position according to that. The next thing we're going to do is check to see if the ball is still on the screen. So lines 122 and 123 are checking the bottom of the screen, and I'll show you that code here. We're just basically comparing, we're saying if the Y position of the ball is greater than the total height of the screen, and we have a little buffer here, we're just subtracting 10. We basically want to say, the height of the ball and 10 more pixels, we want to make sure that there's that kind of a buffer at the bottom of the screen. So if that number is exceeded by the position, which means we're farther down the screen than that limit, then we know we've basically hit our established bottom of the screen. And what do we do then? We just multiply the vertical speed by -1, which will leave the horizontal speed intact, but it basically is going to make the ball reflect off the bottom of the screen and go the opposite direction. And similarly with the top of the screen, it's much simpler actually, because we don't have to worry about the height of the screen. We're basically saying, is the ball's y position less than that 10 unit margin that we have from the edge of the screen? So is it less than 10? Then great, we need to rebound that again, multiply the vertical speed by -1, and get it going the other direction. Again, these things would be easier using vectors, and so as you look into X and A in more detail, please take a look at the Vector 2, Vector 3 classes. They'll help you to do these kinds of things in a more efficient way, but I didn't want to confuse this first demo with those kind of more intermediate concepts. So looking down at the update paddles method that we added as well, it's a little bit more complex because we're doing a few more things. Update paddles has a number of different components. The first of all, the first part of which is that we listen to the user and we move the left paddle according to the input that the user is giving us. So the first set of lines of code here are about looking at the keyboard. And so line 133 says, what's the current state of the keyboard? We'll store it into that variable. And then we'll ask for an array of all the current keys that are being pressed. And we're going to loop through and just figure out what's going on by looking at that set of keys. So lines 139 through 144 are basically reacting to the kinds of keys that we're interested in. So if I'm pressing up on the keyboard or down, we'll adjust the paddle location based on the paddle speed. And just to show you how easy this is, all these things are enumerations. So if I hit keys dot, you'll see that everything is listed here of really a ton of different options related to keyboards. So all the letters, the various function keys, OEM keys are all built into this enumeration. And I can write code to react to whatever keys of interest I may have in the game. And also if you hit the escape key, we're going to run the exit method, which will quit the game. Now to continue on through the update paddles method, we have our world-class artificial intelligence here, lines 148 through 151. You can see it's basically just doing a very simple thing. All it's doing is saying, where is the ball related to the second paddle? The paddle on the right is looking at the ball's location and saying, if it's higher than I am, I'm going to move up. If it's lower, I'm going to move down. Now that's very simple to code, but it's also not the most effective artificial intelligence because it doesn't take into effect anything else. It doesn't think about whether the fact that it might be bouncing off of something right before it gets to it and trying to guess, you know, how better to react to that. So it's actually fairly easy to defeat, but it's easy to code and it's a nice easy demo to walk through. So basically it's just pure geometry. You can look at this code again. You'll have all the code that you can download yourself, but it's basically saying, look at the position of the paddle, the Y position of the paddle, and taking the middle of that and comparing that to where the ball is. And similarly, looking for the down, is it above or is it below me? And that's basically all that's happening within that code. We're also, just like we did in the ball class, we're checking the boundaries of the screen. So from line 154 on, we're also doing a similar code, basically checking the top of the screen. Are we within 10 pixels at the top or 10 units at the top? If we are, then don't change the direction. Just make the paddle stick to the top of the screen. Or I should say stop at the top of the screen. So even if you're continuing to press the up key command, it's not going to go any higher than that 10 location on the screen. And similarly, with the bottom of the screen, we're going to look at the height of the screen and the position of the ball of the paddle plus the height of the paddle. And we're going to make sure that's not within 10 units at the bottom of the screen. And you can see it's a little bit more complex because we have to relate this to the size of the screen and the size of the paddle, which could be different. We could vary that, so we want to write the code appropriately. But we're still using a 10-unit buffer. So if the bottom of the paddle does get within that distance of the bottom of the screen, we'll just basically stick it to that part of the screen as well and not let it go any farther down. So finally, to get these methods added into our game, let's go back up to the update method, and the easiest way to do that is just to choose that from the list here. And in the to-do, we can erase that, and we'll make calls to our own update methods. So we'll say update ball and update paddles, call into those. Now if I run the game, we can see what the effect is of those new methods. Well, you can see there's a problem with the game right off the bat. Although we are able to move the paddle, you can see I can move and not go more than 10 higher or lower, you can see that the ball went right through the paddle. So we're missing some concepts here. We're missing the ability to check whether the paddle interacted with the ball, and whether the ball fell off the screen and the point should end. So we aren't reacting to either of those things. And in fact, if you look at the paddle on the right-hand side, you can see it's still playing the game. It's trying to catch a ball that will never get to it. And so that's the basic, simple AI that's at work here. And we can definitely make improvements to that. So to make the game actually a little bit of fun to play, let's go ahead and add some logic into it to detect collisions. So the ball will actually bounce off of the paddles when they intersect. So let's go ahead and add another method to the bottom here. I will, again, leave full screen and go back to our toolbox. We have a check collisions method that we can import here. I'll bring this in. This actually does quite a bit of stuff for us. So I'm going to go back to full screen and walk through this. So the first thing it does is basically looking at what direction the ball is moving in. And if it's going left, we should only look at the left paddle and compare that to where the ball is. And then conversely, if it's going right, we'll check the right-hand paddle as well. Basically, all we're doing is saying, is the current location of the ball at or beyond the right-hand side of the paddle? So think of it this way. The paddle on the left-hand side has a width, which establishes where the right side of that paddle is. We want to look at that in relation to where the left side of the ball is. And that's all that's happening in this line 168. We're saying is this, you know, within that limit there. And so if it is at that limit, then it's at or past the paddle's location. So we can take a look at the height of the ball. And so line 171 is just looking at, well, okay, we're within the right range to see if it's at the paddle's location. Let's see if it's at the same location as the paddle horizontally. And if it is, then we can react to that. So basically it's saying, let's take a look at the ball's position and add the height in. And let's take a look at the position of the paddle. Has it gone through the paddle? In that case, we reset the game. We say, yeah, you lost it. Let's reset and start a brand new point. Otherwise, we can say the ball actually hit the paddle. And so you can see here, line 180 to 186, it's very much the same code that we had in the ball constructor, and it's saying, instead of just bouncing off by making it -1 to one of the components of the speed, let's make it a little bit more random. So we add in some random features here to say, so it doesn't always bounce off the same way. Again, here's another chance for you to write better code. You could actually put in code that reacts to, for example, how close to the edge of the paddle the ball intersected with the paddle at, and maybe make it bounce more quickly or at a more acute angle based on that. But this is just basically doing a default of randomizing its bounce every time it hits it. And the rest of this method does the converse, basically checking the right-hand paddle and doing the same kind of reset point or bouncing the ball off in a random direction. So to get that to interact with our game, let's go back to the update method again. And here it is. And after we update the ball and the paddles, we can call the check collisions method. And let's go ahead and run the game now. And let's see the impact that we had. So now, there we go. We've actually had the impact with the ball and the paddle. It's detected that one. I'll let it go by this time so we can see that the point actually does reset once it hits the edge of the paddle and determines that it's not at the paddle's location. And so you can see it's resetting, it's randomizing everything, it's calling the constructors again to put the paddles back in the middle of the screen, and then regenerating a new ball instance with a random direction. Ooh, I'm getting killed here. So basically you can see that the collisions and the updates are all happening appropriately now. The draw method is doing everything it should, and we've got the beginnings of what could be a decent game. So as the last part of the demo, we'll add a little bit of visual interest to the game by using some of the other assets that we had imported through the content pipeline, but haven't yet written code to load and use within the game. So to do that, we'll define a new state for the game called evolved, and I'll create a variable here, boolean evolved equals true. And we'll use this in various parts of the code to determine which assets to load and use in the game. So the next thing to do is to go to the load content method, which you see here. We're going to update this to honor that evolved setting and to basically load different assets based on it. Let me get out a full screen just to show you what I'm talking about. In the content pipeline, again, to recall, we had right-clicked before and added the existing items of the various ball and paddle images in addition to a Pong underscore background bitmap. So we can go ahead and use these asset names in our code based on whether the evolved key has been set. And let's go ahead and remove the old code. And I'll insert the updated load content call. We'll put that in there. And let's go to full screen just so I can talk through the code. At the top, we have a new background batch, which I'll copy so I can define at the top of the page. And that's a new sprite batch that we're using to print the display the background image that we're now loading. You can see here, content.load is exactly the same. It's also a textured 2D. And we're going to the Pong underscore BKG asset name. Now, it doesn't matter that that's a bitmap versus a ping file. The content importer will take care of all of that for us and place the resulting texture inside the texture2D variable on the left-hand side. We also have some other code here that's conditional. It's basically saying if we're evolved, let's use the same code that we have used earlier. In fact, if you looked at line 73 to 75 and 79 to 81, they're the same, except on the right-hand side, where we change the asset names based on whether we're in the evolved state or not. And so in that case, we've got really the same code, we've just chosen different assets. Okay, so that's fine. Let's go back to the top of the page, and I'm going to add in that new background sprite batch. So I'll insert that, and we should be all set now. So I haven't done anything to the screen yet. I've loaded different assets, and those will render. But I also want to add some logic to the draw method that will then take advantage of the evolve tag to then decide whether or not to print the background. So I'm going to go ahead and insert down here in draw. Let's leave full screen so I can insert this, the evolve draw logic here. And again, let's take a look at that. So if we're in the evolve state, we're going to use that background batch that I defined earlier. And just like we have below, we're going to begin and end a session with that sprite batch. And we're going to draw, in this case, just one texture, the background. And we're going to use a rectangle that's defined as the top left corner of the screen, and then also, based on the height and width of the screen, the bottom right of the screen. And we'll use a neutral white effect on that as well. And all that's going to do is just render the background for us. Now I want to point out, in fact, I'll copy this to the wrong place. I want to point out a subtle but important issue that you might run into. I'm going to put this down here. We're going to print out if evolve will actually display the background to the screen. Let me go ahead and hit run. Now this will bring up the game, and actually what you see here is the game is running, and it's actually playing behind the scenes, but you can't see it. And this is because the things that we're printing to the screen happen essentially in order, by default, they'll happen in order of the code that we've written in the draw method. And so in the draw method, the last thing I did was display the screen, the background for the screen, which of course takes up the entire screen. So it's actually covering up everything else that we're trying to do on the screen. So it's making for an even less fun game than it was to begin with. So I'll close that down. Let's put the code back to where I had it originally, and now let's run it so you can see the fully evolved version of the game. So here we go. We've got really the same code running. We've just chosen to load different assets by name based on the evolved tag, and now we have the background instead of the plain dark green, and we also have new textures that we're applying to both the paddles and to the ball. All right, so that concludes our look at the Pong demonstration, your first game in XNA. And there's plenty of things you could do to improve it, of course. You can add better artificial intelligence for the right-hand paddle. You could add a better collision code for when the ball bounces off the paddle. It could basically depend on where you hit the paddle. It could be a different velocity or a different direction based on where that collision happens. You could also add a scoreboard, keep track of how many points each side has earned, and then use the Sprite Font class to display the text to the screen for the scoreboard. You could also add in some sounds, and in fact, in a future screencast, I'll walk through the various options that we have in XNA for working with audio inside of games. But primarily, you have a couple of main choices, the EXACT tool, or cross-platform audio creation tool, as part of XNA, And with XNA3, there's a class called Sprite Sound Effect that you can use to do more simple effects with sounds in the game if you don't need all the features that Exact offers. And so to download this code so you can work with it, work through all these demonstrations, and then extend it with your own ideas, just go to our portal on Channel 9, which is right here. If you go to channel9.msdn.com/northeast, on the right-hand side, you'll see there's a link for previous Roadshow materials. If you click there, this was originally part of the Spring 2009 series, and you can see there's an XNA session there. You can get the code and the slides, download that, and work with it as you wish. Okay, and with that, I'll leave you with some resources. We'll switch to slides for just a second here. And next steps. First of all, get started using XNA. Just download it, and you can go to creators.xna.com, pull down Game Studio, and install that on top of any version of Visual Studio 2008. You can also go to the XNA team blog, blogsmsdn.com/XNA. And the last two links are for recordings of prior conference sessions around XNA. So the Game Developer Conference 2009, plenty of great recordings from that conference, as well as prior years of GameFest, which has plenty of XNA content as well. So check out those links for more intermediate to advanced content as you wish. With that, thanks very much for listening to the screencast. I appreciate your time. Again, my name's Chris Bowen, and you can reach me at cbowen@microsoft.com. Thanks again, and take care.